Welcome back to Midday. On May 27th, 2015, soccer fans around the world awoke stunned to see their senior officials from FIFA, the sport's governing body, arrested for corruption and the organization's $200 million Zurich headquarters raided by Swiss police. More shocking than the corruption was the fact that the U.S. Department of Justice led the investigation. In Red Card, How the U.S. Blew the Whistle on the World's Biggest Sports Scandal, Ken Benzinger unravels the riveting and intricate story of how an elite team of FBI and IRS agents toppled the largest sports organization in the world. It's published by Simon & Schuster. I'm happy it brings Ken Benzinger on the show today. Hey, Ken, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm so great. Thanks for having me.
For those of us who don't follow soccer, which is, I imagine, much of America, what is FIFA and what role does it play in professional soccer?
I'm not going to give the French name for FIFA, where the acronym comes from, because I'll butcher the pronunciation. but it's an organization founded in 1904, and it governs all world soccer in the world, even down to the lowest levels, or somewhere down the tree from FIFA, which is in Zurich. And so the president of FIFA is sort of the king of all soccer in the world, and below him and all the levels below them radiate out from it.
So it's professional and amateur soccer. They control both.
They govern the rules applying to all those. The professional leagues tend to have their own corporate structures around them. So MLS in the U.S., for example, is run by a corporation. The English Premier League, which is very popular here and elsewhere, also is a corporate thing. But the rules applying to it and their schedule and their calendar all
the World Cup.
The World Cup is run by FIFA.
Right.
That's its own thing. But there's a master schedule of everything that's controlled by FIFA.
How did FIFA become such a powerful organization?
I think it became powerful because soccer is enormously powerful, popular. I think no one could have predicted how it swept the world. There's, by some estimates, over 3 billion people who are fans of soccer. That's about at least double, adherence to the Catholic Church. It's everywhere. And because it's the thing that everyone loves, the organization that runs it is going to be powerful. They have the golden goose, so to speak, the thing that everyone wants. And so it's really amassed an incredible amount of power because of that.
In your book, you say that FIFA seems to be run like a criminal organization. Could you describe the power structure of FIFA?
Yeah. So this is something, the criminal organization idea is something that came from the prosecutors who ultimately investigated FIFA. What they found was that FIFA operates a lot like the kind of mafia crime families we saw in Brooklyn in the bad old days. You have someone atop it, sort of a capo, as they would call it, and below him they have lieutenants and they have consiglieri, lawyers, and you have soldiers and different layers of people. I mean, of course, the FIFA people didn't call themselves consiglieria and capos, but it functioned that way, that was a top-down run organization, which each level had its own sort of carve-out responsibility areas, but they all answered to the top. And they all participated in similar schemes. And so the kind of corrupt acts that affected FIFA at the highest level were also affecting it at lower levels in a very sort of mirror-type fashion. You'd see the same thing at every level.
Where did it get its money?
So FIFA gets its money principally from television and sponsorship. So the World Cup is the number one source of revenue for FIFA. But these other leagues we mentioned get their own revenue from TV as well. And then you have giant corporate sponsors like Coca-Cola or other brands that put their name all over their events and their stadiums, that sort of thing. And collectively, we're talking many, many millions of dollars a year.
You talk about a top-down structure. So Sepp Blatter would have been on top for quite some time, right?
Yeah, from 1998 until 2015.
How did he maintain that power?
So he maintained it principally through what we might think of as political patronage. All this money that comes into FIFA's coffers, he was then pushing out to all the regional soccer officials around the world. And he would make promises every time he ran for president, saying, look, I've gave you this much last time. I'm going to give you even more this time. The amount of money we're getting in has increased, and therefore my largesse is going to get more. And so by paying out money to all these officials in Trinidad and in Congo and in Sri Lanka, he was buying their loyalty.
I mean, I think we should, reinforce the scope of this, right? Because I think we talk about, the NFL or Major League Baseball or the NBA, and we have a sense of if there's a scandal, how big that is. How much money are we talking about in terms of an industry, and how many countries is this entailing?
Well, FIFA books a revenue, I think, of around $5 or $6 billion every 4-year cycle of the World Cup. And that's how they measure That's how they do their books, is on a 4-year cycle. So that's FIFA's revenue. And that's independent of the revenues that come in the regional confederation. So in North America as a confederation, that includes Central America and Caribbean. They have their own tournaments and their own sources of income. South America has their own tournaments, their own sources of income. So you start adding them all up and you're talking, multiple billions of dollars a year worldwide.
So a scandal is affecting that much money potentially.
That's right. And that many countries. I mean, you mentioned scope. Think about this. There's 193, I believe, members of the United Nations.
Wow.
But there are 211 members of FIFA. So there's actually more countries involved in FIFA than the United Nations.
Yeah, I guess the question is which one is more ineffective, I suppose. Who is Chuck Blazer and what impact did he have on American soccer?
Chuck Blazer was a New Yorker. He grew up in Queens and went to Forest Hills High School, I believe, which is where the Ramones, I think, went to high school as well. So illustrious. And he was the ultimate sort of suburban soccer dad. He had moved to Westchester County, New Rochelle, and his kids were playing youth soccer in the late 70s when there was a soccer boom. And he grew from the guy cutting up oranges and giving out snacks after the games to one of the 24 most powerful people in all global soccer. That guy who said, if I ran this show, this is what I do. Well, he did run this show. He reached the top kind of amazingly and was a larger than life character. This is a very large, physically large man. He weighed about 450 pounds, had a big shaggy beard, liked to drive. He couldn't walk very well because he had bad diabetes, and he would roll around Central Park on a scooter with a parrot on his shoulder. Really quite a character.
And he never played soccer himself.
Never played the sport, never played sports, but he was brilliant at making money from the sport, because while he was running soccer in North and Central America and the Caribbean and playing a role on the executive committee of FIFA, he was also skimming shocking amounts of money from the sport. He took at least $20 million from the sport and over the course of his career, not including the incredible expense account use he had, which was to put everything on soccer's credit card, including the rent for his apartment, including secondary apartments he owned that threw soccer in Miami and the Bahamas, including vehicles, everything. And none of it was money that he accounted for in any public way. He was secretly taking all of his money.
Were there other ways that, was Sepp Blatter doing the same thing? And what were the other ways that they made their money?
Well, Sepp Blatter has been called corrupt, but no one's ever actually fingered him for taking a bribe. The only thing he's ever been accused of criminally, for which he's investigation now, is actually potentially paying a bribe. Huh. He denies it's a bribe, but he paid $1 million to someone who was going to run against him for president. And that person stopped running, and the implication was that it was a bribe, so the guy wouldn't run against him. Blatter denies it and says it was a payment for a service the guy rendered years earlier. But what Blatter's biggest issue really was that people thought he turned a blind eye to the corruption, that his desire, his lust for power meant that he would ignore what was going on around him, would let people be corrupt. And the way they would be corrupt, in part, was selling their votes within FIFA, sure, but also the part that came out in the criminal case that really wasn't as well understood was that all these rights deals we mentioned earlier, all the TV and sponsorship deals, always involved broker middlemen, and those middlemen were paying bribes to get the rights. So they would bribe soccer officials under the table in exchange for sweetheart deals to get to resell the TV and sponsorship rights. And their business depended on the bribes, because they could get the rights for less than market value, then turn around and sell them for a profit.
Now, I want to get to the World Cup, because that's pivotal in this. But first of all, why do countries want to host the World Cup to begin with? I mean, so many people get displaced, so much money is spent. What is it about the World Cup that attracts people?
You know, it's a great question.
I think attracts countries, I should say.
Yeah, I know, it's a great question. I mean, we've seen the Olympics too, right? I mean, these countries get economically devastated. Brazil is now the poster child for this, right? Brazil hosted the World Cup and the Olympics within a 2-year span, and the country's basically in tatters at this point. I think of it as there's two kinds of countries that want to host the World Cup. One, large economically well-developed countries like the U.S. or Britain, and two, countries that have a political agenda. And the well-developed countries like the U.S. can do it because they already have the infrastructure, and there actually is a big potential for making money. The U.S. hosted the World Cup in 1994. It was enormously financially successful. It made a huge profit. When Los Angeles held the 1984 Olympics, it was, I think, the most profitable Olympics of all time, and incredibly well run. By comparison, Russia's doing a World Cup now. South Africa did one in 2010. And everyone knows they don't have the resources to build these stadiums. And to do it, they have to just basically tear a hole in their economy. So then you question, well, why are they doing it? And the answer ultimately probably isn't economic. It has to do with image and standing. And people like Vladimir Putin or South Africa's rulers at the time want the world to know that they can do this. They want to have the prestige of showing this, of being on TV screens around the world on this, you know, in the best seat in the stadium, looking down on everyone. That's what they're buying.
Well, that being said, you write that following the December 2nd, 2010 vote, which selected Russia and Qatar as future World Cup hosts, Secretary General of FIFA Jerome Valcke kept saying, "This is the end of FIFA." What was the significance of that vote?
Oh, I mean, it was really a before and after for FIFA. It was the moment when everyone, the veil was off and everyone realized that these kinds of votes were clearly up for grabs, because Russia beat out England for it. And England was one of those countries, as I just mentioned, that had the economic wherewithal to host the tournament basically tomorrow. I mean, England, if Russia today couldn't do it because there was an earthquake, England could put the cup on in about a month. They're just prepared to do it. They have beautiful stadiums and beautiful hotels, etc. So, and Russia beating them out was very suspicious. And likewise, Qatar beat out the U.S. And the U.S., again, just like England, was incredibly well prepared to do it. Qatar is a postage stamp sized country that, yes, has a lot of money, but they almost don't have the geographical room to put in all the stadiums. And the climate is incredibly inhospitable. We're talking about temperatures at 115 degrees in the summer. You can't play soccer in that, and people don't want to sit in a stadium in that. And so the fact that these two countries win, everyone says, oh, there's something really rotten in Denmark, or in this case, Switzerland.
Let's get to some of the juicy bits now. Like, so how did the FBI get involved in this investigation, and how come they have jurisdiction when the organization they're investigating is in Switzerland?
Yeah, good question. So the origins of this case are pretty juicy and timely and feel very very much of the moment today. If you want to point to one person who got this case started, it's a British spy by the name of Christopher Steele, who I'm sure the audience has heard of. Christopher Steele left the MI6, which is British Spy Service, to start a corporate research firm. One of his first clients was the English bid when they were trying to get that World Cup. And he was brought in to do research on Russia, and what he found was unsettling. He told the English bid, about that. But he thought that wasn't enough. And so he contacted someone he'd recently met with the FBI, an agent who was specialized in Russian organized crime here in New York City. That agent flew to London, met with him. And Christopher Steele said, look, you got to look into Russia and you got to look into FIFA. There's really bad stuff happening. That agent comes back to New York, finds a prosecutor in Brooklyn where the Eastern District of New York operates, federal district. And that young and very smart, ambitious young prosecutor by the name of Evan Norris decides to open the case. So that's how it began, right? And then Evan Norris's challenge was what you said. How do I get jurisdiction on this? How do I tackle a corrupt organization that mostly operates outside the U.S.? And there was a couple ways to do it that they came up with that were pretty ingenious. But the best and most strong came through the help of the IRS. There was an agent in California, of all places, in Orange County, who worked his way into the case, a brilliant agent by the name of Steve Berryman. And he understood how money moves. He was a money laundering expert, and he understood where money moves around the world, and that all these bribes were paid, and they might have been paid between Brazil and Argentina, or between Trinidad and somewhere in Europe. But he understood that no matter where those bribes were paid, they almost always went through American banks on their way. All these wire transfers between these countries travel through New York. They travel through the U.S. They travel different banking institutions here because of our banking system. And every one of those transfers coming through gave a toehold for jurisdiction.
Well, how did Berryman ultimately convince Chuck Blazer to cooperate with the investigation, considering obviously he had a ton to lose?
Watershed moment right there, right? So Berryman, as an IRS agent, has the power that FBI agents and others don't do, which is look at tax records. When he got interested in the case, he pulled up Blazer's tax file and discovered there was no tax file. Chuck Blazer, who had been stealing all this money from the sport, had been hiding it and hiding his income and hadn't filed taxes in at least 17 years, I believe. And so from an IRS agent's perspective, that's an open shut case. All he has to do is prove that there was income, which he did. And then they went to the Trump Tower where Chuck Blazer lived. And they said, Mr. Blazer, we have a proposition for you. We can basically throw you in prison for years, up to 30 years, I think was the statutory limit. Or you can flip and cooperate with us and help us build this case. And Blazer did it.
The IRS does offer that proposition quite a bit, and it tends to work.
Yeah, I mean, people flip. When the option is go to prison, people flip.
Yeah.
But of course, flipping is an unpleasant proposition. It means that you're going to inform on your friends. You're going to make phone calls and go to dinners with people wearing a wire, and you're going to provide evidence against them. So it's a big deal. But in the end, especially when you're talking about FIFA executives, they're gonna rat out their friends.
What did they discover?
They discovered, and they learned from him, that the entire sport was riddled from top to bottom with corruption. It wasn't just at the level of the votes in the FIFA Executive Council. It was at every level of the sport, what Evan Norris called endemic. It was a problem that was everywhere, and that that the biggest source of day-to-day bribery were these TV and sponsorship deals. And so Blazer taught them that, and then Blazer delivered them their other really critical cooperator, was a Brazilian by the name of José Ávila. And he, unlike Blazer, who took the bribes, Ávila was the guy who paid the bribes. And the IRS and FBI arrested him in Miami in 2013. In May 2013, they went to him in his hotel and they arrested him and forced him to stay in the country and cooperate as well.
I mean, so at the end of all this investigating, did it clean up FIFA, or is there still a ton of corruption?
I think it would be fair to say there's still a ton of corruption. The way I think of this is like a sick tree. They didn't want to kill FIFA. They didn't want to get rid of soccer, but they wanted to clean it up. And the first thing to do was to cut off the diseased part of the tree. And the next part is the healing. And I think the prosecutors writing the case never thought that their prosecution would immediately solve the sport's problems. It was step one. And I think there's impatience among the world soccer fans for everything to be perfect now, but it's helpful to think of it as a long process. I think FIFA is trying to move in that direction, but you're talking about literally decades of ingrained culture of corruption that have to be cleaned up.
Ken, thank you so much for joining us today. I've been speaking with Ken Benzinger, author of the book Red Card: FIFA and the Fall of the Most Powerful Men in Sports.